Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. It's good to have you with us. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden. And a new week is upon us, and we are half into May already. I hope you're enjoying that it's heating up again. Summer is finally just around the corner. Well, our show today is with Gilad Atman, who returns with us to discuss his latest publication, A to Zion, the Definitive Israeli Lexicon, a fictitious satire that is co-authored with the cartoonist Enzo Appiacella. Gilad is a British jazz artist and author who was born in Israel and trained in composition and jazz at the Rubin Academy of Music in Jerusalem. He is a member of the Blockheads, founded the Orient House Ensemble in London, and has recorded and performed with the many rock music legends. He also writes on political matters, social issues, Jewish identity, and culture. Gilad, welcome back. It's always a pleasure speaking with you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm today in Madison. I'm touring, signing this new book of mine, new satirical book.
Yeah.
So far, all events were full houses, pretty much sold out. We had an amazing event in New York where I had an interesting exchange with a very intelligent rabbi, Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro, who had some very interesting things to say about Judaism and Jewishness. We are almost kind of, you know, you might even say intellectual twins. And then I started to do my book signing tour. Denver was a full house. LA was, I was really afraid of LA because it was on a Mother's Day. It was last Sunday. Mm-hmm. And I realized that a lot of people told me, listen, I'll have to come, but you know, it's Mother's Day, my wife, my mother, and you know, and I had a full house, and then I realized that I tapped into new market, orphans for Palestine. You know.
Oh yeah.
Orphans for Palestine. I think it sounds almost as idiotic as Jews for Palestine, and it works for me. you know, but right. Yesterday I was traveling. The day before I was in San Diego. In few of the events, we had the JVP, the people who are supposed to be our allies in support of Palestine. They tried to jeopardize the event. They put pressure on venues, pressure on members of the public not to attend. And I'm actually very, very happy. I welcome this approach. I think that they should celebrate their symptoms in public because it make my life much easier. You know, I'm talking about Jewish power as the capacity to silence discussion on Jewish power, and then they just provide the good. You know, I just pointed them.
Right.
So, yeah, I hope that they never finish. Obviously, they failed.
You know, like we spoke about last time, Gilad, I mean, you've been doing kind of a full-on U.S. tour here with the book and everything and signings. And has there been any complaints or problems along the way, anyway?
No, the only problem we had Jews putting pressure on venues, left Jews, not even Zionists. Can you believe it?
Really? Wow.
Yeah. So this is the issue, but it's not a major issue for me. I'm happy to engage in debate, and when they try to, you know, in the old days when I started, and this is something that actually I should share with your listeners, because as they are moving forward to say what they believe and think, as they should, they may encounter, I say they may, I'm polite here, they'll necessarily encounter some Jewish outrage behavior, and they will be labeled as anti-Semite, and you know, and when it happened to me, like you know, they call me an anti-Semite, you know, and I was quite you know, hurt when I hurt it, because I really hate everyone equally. And I was kind of surprised. I thought, well, how can I? Since when are you Semite? You right. Bunch of Kazarians. You know, I couldn't understand it. You know, then they called me a Holocaust denier, and I really never denied any Holocaust. I just asked why. Do they encounter such a Shoah every 50 years? This is my question. And all those questions, and it takes some time to develop tactics and thick skin to engage in those, to engage with those issues. And yeah. Now I can see that I'm surrounded with people who know those Jewish tactics, who are tired of it. We have a big movement of people who openly express fatigue of Jewish left. More and more people understand that Zionism is very bad and Israeli racism is very bad, but it is actually the Jewish left that is the core of the problem. Jewish left is not the solution. Mm. It is the core of the problem. And why? Because while Zionism is a celebration of the Jewish symptom, as they see it, you know, there can be a debate. You know, Rabbi Shapiro, for instance, doesn't understand that they celebrate what he interpret as Jewish symptom, but they definitely interpret why they regard as Jewish symptom. The Jewish left has one goal: to deny us the access to discuss what these symptoms are.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
While the Israeli state is celebrating its Jewish ideology in public, they just the cabinet just passed 4 months ago the Jewish National Bill that determines that Israel policy and practice is driven by Jewish ideology.
They're open about it. You know, they own it, right? And they don't try to hide it. And that's a step forward to a certain extent than to try to cover up the whole debate, right?
I totally agree, and this is why I'm so happy with Netanyahu being elected. You know, right. I'm delighted.
Yeah,
I'm delighted
because it's gonna become more. I guess more. More reason to debate the issue, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. So, this is the real issue here, you know. And then we find out that the name of the Mondo Wise really banned any attempt to discuss. Jewish crimes of Israel in the context of Jewish culture. So my most interesting take on it is now to examine, and this is what I'm doing in America. I'm moving from city to city, talking to a lot of people who are spreading this message. I show them how the domination of Jews within the Solidarity Movement have destroyed the Palestinian people and how it diverted the Palestinian solidarity from the root cause, from the real issues. And I can talk about it with you, which is very, I think that it's a very interesting topic, but it is very, very interesting not because of Palestine, because they are always doing the same trick. It's manipulating the terminology, hegemony within the discourse, which set what are the boundaries. And at the moment, the Palestinians are just going de jour, our daily going. You know, in the beginning of the 20th century, it was the Turkish people who were robbed of their language and their culture by what we realize now to be predominantly a Jewish ideology, the Ataturk school. This is the way the Turks see it. I'm not an expert on this issue, but even some Israeli scholars agree that the new Turk, the young Turks, were primarily a Jewish school of thought. You know, the Bolsheviks robbed, which was a predominantly a Jewish lefty setting, robbed the Russian people of their of their traditions and the cultural home. You know, and then they did it in the Spanish Civil War. Quarter of the combatants in the International Brigade, and I'm not saying that they were bad guys. They were stupid enough to believe that they are doing the right thing. I'm almost sure that most of the Jews who joined JVP and have robbed the Palestinians of their cause, which is something that I'm happy to explore, believe that they are doing the right thing. They're not doing it because they are necessarily sinister or conspiratorial. I don't think that there are conspiracies in a Jewish political culture. This is one of the most fascinating things, that Jews are doing those things in the open.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want, I'll show you how I explore this this theme when it comes to Palestine. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, do you want to speak a little bit about the book first, maybe? You just tell us how it came together and tell us about the artist. It's hilarious, by the way. I've really been enjoying it. Tell us about it.
Because the way I introduced the book is through these issues to do with Palestine. Yeah, but let's talk about the book, and then we come back to Palestine.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, Palestine is just a case study. You know, you can talk about America and to see how they rob people around us here in the States of ability to think through political correctness. It's exactly the same trick.
Yeah, that's right.
What I realized, okay, the book. I really, really, really like aphorism. My mentor, philosopher Otto Weininger, was spectacularly good in that art form. Aphorism is the ability to reduce a concept, an idea, a vision, a precept into one sentence that is more than revealing. And I always ended my fictional books with a set of those aphorisms. And one day, like 2 or 3 years ago, my friend, the great cartoonist, Enzo Apicella, you know, we had dinner together.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me, Gilad, why don't you just make a book of aphorisms? And it was very exciting. You know, I thought, wow, what a great idea. And it took me basically, I don't know, 2-3 weeks to come up with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I did A, B, C, you know. So I started with A, I thought, Al-Qaeda. you know, it's actually, I decided to write those books of definitions from an Israeli perspective. So Al-Qaeda serves to make Muslims look crazier than us. Yasser Arafat, from an Israeli perspective, didn't react well to Polonium 210. anti-Semites, brutally honest people, often of Jewish origin. Auschwitz, a usually popular Jewish tourist destination.
Oh, you know? Ouch.
No, but it's true. It's all true, isn't it? Arab Spring, a lot of Arab killing each other. It serves as the trouble. But, you know, it goes under the belt.
Yeah.
Bar mitzvah, the moment when the male Jew accepts that his foreskin is not going to grow back.
Yeah, yeah.
And it goes on and on and on.
There's some great ones in there, Gilad. Yeah, BBC, the Muslims say it's Islamophobic. We say it's anti-Semitic. We all know for sure that what they do is fiddle with kids.
You know, exactly. Accuracy is very important. Canaan, the land of milking money.
That's right. I like that one too. That's
Catch 22, free ham. You know. So it goes on and on.
How important is humor, Gilad, in all of this to be able to break down some of the seriousness around all of this stuff?
I don't know. Jews are always very proud of their humor. And maybe to a certain extent, my humor is mildly Jewish or hugely Jewish. I don't know. I cannot judge. So let's see whether they can cope with me ridiculing their culture. Mm. So far, I must admit, so far, quite a few Jews saw the book and were very entertained. So maybe they can take it. I hope that they can take it. I hope that. I think that the idea of aphorism, short sentences, short ideas, is a very good, effective way to deliver a message. This is, I guess, the reason that Twitter is so popular.
I was just going to say, so it can be posted on Twitter. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I guess that many of those entries will be, because I see a lot of people tweeting my, Jewish power, the capacity to silence the discussion on Jewish power. You know, when I managed to come with such a simple idea, you know, there is a sense of epiphany. You know, this kind of it feels like liberation. And these are the things that drive me. The reason that I work on those issues on Jews is not because I hate Jews. I am not really familiar with the sense of hatred. I'm doing it because I'm fascinated. I'm actually fascinated by their method, by their success,
mm-hmm.
By the danger, the disasters that they inflict upon themselves. And every day I get like a leftist and Jewish leftist in particular, why do you try to say that we brought it all on ourselves? And is there any question? You know, this is the most obvious thing about Jewish culture. What is more fascinating that how much they get out of it.
What would you mean?
You know, when every Jewish disaster becomes a facilitate a huge step forward in terms of Jewish politics. Would you be able to imagine the Jewish state without the Holocaust?
No.
You know, can you? See, you know, how all those Holocaust museums are spreading in America like mushrooms. Instead of Americans looking into the crimes, the huge, colossal crimes that they inflicted on other people, whether it is Native Americans or even, you know, you can look at Iraq. You know, we are talking about Iraq, Afghanistan, about some people say up to 5 million fatalities due to this criminal war, you know, Anglo-American war. You can look at what America did in Germany and Japan in World War II.
Yeah.
This merciless campaign and industrial, this is the only confirmed military institutional murderous project against civilians. And you know, a lot of people talk up now about the Hellstorm, and I'm touring, so I didn't have time to post this film, but it's a very important film. I'm slightly troubled with the delivery, but I must admit that when I read the book by Goodrich Hellstrom many years ago, I think maybe 10 years ago or something, when it came out, this book changed my life. It made me feel sick. Guilty. I think that the film is very, very well made. I just couldn't take it for more than 30 minutes at a time.
Yeah, so, I know.
It is so devastating. It took me 3 days to watch it, this video. And I thought that it was slightly too opinionated. Not that I disagree with a single thing they say there. But, you know, there is enough in the story itself to deliver a message without imposing a kind of a political standpoint. But you know, I don't have any right to criticize it. I just thought that there was a bit of a miss there. But but it's I think that everyone should watch it. One thing that they missed, and I spoke about it in LA in the film, and this is something that we have to understand, and I can get into a lot of trouble for saying it, but I think that this is the truth, and if it's not the truth, it's because I must have missed some crucial knowledge that is not available for us. The tactical bombers, B-17, B-25, the Lancaster, the British Lancasters, that deliver these colossal, lethal attacks over German cities were not, didn't come to life in summer 40. They were designed since the late 20s. And early 30s, which means that both Americans and Brits saw the war as something that should be celebrated on the expense of innocent civilians. This is something very devastating. While the German didn't have tactical bombers, you know, we all the time talk about the Blitz over London. At the time when I learned about it, we spoke about 47,000 civilians, which is a lot of people, but it's really nothing in comparison to the amount of civilians. This is less than what the number of civilians who died in Hamburg in one night.
Yeah, yeah.
1914, summer 40. So the Germans didn't have the machinery. They didn't even design. They didn't think. And they were the most technologically advanced. There is no doubt about that. Till the end of the war, they had the most advanced airplanes. They were flying jets before anyone else in the end of the war.
Yeah.
You know, they had the technology, but wiping out cities wasn't part of their strategy.
Of course not. That was not.
All right.
No.
And this is a crucial. This is a crucial point that actually could have made the Hellstorm, the film, even more transparent. You know, the idea that we go and flatten cities and kill millions of civilians in order to terrorize civilians population and to create that may into a political impact was something that is embedded and still embedded in Anglo-American philosophy. It is very, 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 it is totally devastating. And you see, instead of selling my books, I sell other people books. This is so non-Jewish of me.
Right.
Yeah, let's talk about me.
Do you want to, we could, so how do you hook up with the artist, by the way? It was just an old friend, you said, and he just, you guys just decided to do it?
Enzo Apicella, it's an amazing guy. He's 92 years old. He has more energy between his toes that I had managed to accumulate like my entire life. He contacted me when The Wandering Who came out 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and insisted that we meet. And I, since then, you know, fell in love with his work. I think that he's a unique cartoonist. You know, there is something about him. It's, you know, when you deal with Jewish subjects, it's very easy to fall into the stereotype, to do the Jew with the big nose and so on and so on. And he is totally clean of any of it, and yet deliver kind of a multi-layered message in just few lines. I admire the guy. And it was, as I said, it was his idea that I come out with this book. And he just then, you know, provided the few of the illustrations. It was a lot of fun working with him. His energy is enormous. It was him who pushed us to publish, you know, because I really wrote it like, I don't know, 2 years ago and two, 3 weeks, you know, to get around it. My son, my son then was 12 years old. He contributed some great entries. I think that he said Old Testament, he came, he said almost as violent as Tarantino.
Right, yeah.
I think still in the book. There was another... a friend of mine, Jewish comedian, is called a comedy terrorist, is living in London. I gave him I thanked him, Aaron Barshak. I thanked him in the book. He gave some of the best entries. He came up with some of the best entries that are part of his comedy routine. And I can see, you know, what is happening. I think that I didn't bring enough books, you know, like in San Diego, you know, we just sold out, and you know, it's like a lot of people want to laugh a bit. I think that the only way to deal with these issues is to have a bit of a laughter, because this allows us to dismantle this deep fear of touching the subject.
Yeah, I agree.
You know,
yeah.
We are afraid to talk about Jews. They've managed to castrate our ability to deal with their policy momentarily. The only way to deal with it is to crack a joke.
Yeah,
and we can start to deal with it again.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's just so charged, you know, and a lot of these, you know, kind of jokes and whatnot has been used very effectively against, I think, to kind of create the climate that we're in now of political correctness, everything, you know, of bamboozling people into self censorship and other kinds of things, and making fun of people and you know, joking about them. So
to
a certain extent, we have to return the salvo and take control of. Of not only humor, but you know, the language again, and I think this helps to do that. It's a really
Now I can see you know, it is very interesting because for more than a while we can see Jews dominating the comedy industry in the West, especially in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is why they are so in France, for instance, they are horrified by Dieudonné.
Yep, that's right. No,
he's not succumbing to the Holocaust religion, and he's not even a Jew. It's almost a crime. He said, my Holocaust is far greater. Look at me. You know, and they want to see him annihilated. It's quite devastating. I think that we have to deal with these issues. Since I came to the States, you know, I can see the reaction to Pamela Geller. I saw her on CNN, and I can see that there is actually a growing fatigue of this crazy Zionist push for hatred, you know, and we understand now the tricks, you know. It's not, you know, my issue, for instance, I said it immediately after when Charlie Hebdo happened, this massacre. I said, yes, we have in America, for instance, we have First Amendment. In Europe, we accept the notion of freedom of speech, but there is also responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And there is also ethics. And the Jews who taught us to talk about otherness, Emmanuel Levinas and all these crappers, you know, where is their all their understanding of otherness? Does it die out when you go out of the LGBT discourse?
Right, exactly.
Does it die out right. when it comes to Muslims? Does it die out when it comes to white people?
Yeah, it does.
You know, and this is the issue. This is the issue, and this is the sense of chosenness. I am tired of identity politics. It is the most dangerous things that happened to the West. It is a tactic, a cultural tactic, that was set to split between us, to destroy human brotherhood. And at the center of this depletious ideology, we find Jewish left merchants a la Frankfurt Yeshiva. I don't even call them Frankfurt School anymore.
Mm-hmm, right.
It's a Frankfurt Yeshiva.
Yeah.
It's a bunch of very, very dangerous and slightly clever tribal operators that introduced a system that was there to destroy the working class.
Yeah, while you know, pretending that it's on its side, you know. Of course.
And if some people now, I wrote about it something yesterday. You know, the way in which one of the reasons that it fall apart is because no one achieved anything out of it except the Jews, which is very interesting. You know, and why it sets. It split a society into sectors. This is very clear. People start to talk as a Jew, as a Muslim, as a gay, as a lesbian, as a woman, as a feminist, as a black, and so on and so on and so on. But each identity becomes a meaningful identity once it can present a binary division between the oppressed and the oppressor. So the women are oppressed by the patriarchal society, by the masculinity. The gays are oppressed by the homophobe. The black are oppressed by the white. The Jews are oppressed by everyone. which is exactly the division between Jew and Goy. Now, this is very, very interesting, because while the the notion of the oppressed is very clear to the oppressed. You know, I guess that black who speak this language, they know exactly what they talk about. You know, when Palestinians speak about Palestinian, now we try to make them also into an identity politics, and it's not, it's a national. But in the eyes of Jewish left, it is an identity discourse. So when they speak about Zionists, but they speak about themselves as Palestinians, they know exactly who is Palestinian. The feminists know exactly who is a feminist. Then the vision, the notion of the oppressed is very, very clear. Yet the notion of the oppressor is abstract and everything but lucid. So, for instance, those people who talk about the white, I'm quite whitish, yeah? So they talk about the white. Am I an oppressor of, let's say, sort of black people or black culture? No, actually, I devoted my life to play jazz. Yeah, when the women talk about masculinity, I'm quite, you know, people regard me as an alpha male. Am I an oppressor of any woman, or ideologically or pragmatically? Not really. And this is the trick here. This is the trick. It's very, very interesting.
Well, isn't this what they've done as well, that they kind of, you know, you don't know that you're an oppressor, right? It's an unconscious process. It's systemic, etc.
Exactly. But this is exactly why it couldn't go anywhere.
Right,
What really happened with this, all those identity discourse, and there are quite a few morons who follow these political schools. What happened is that when you start to see yourself as a victim, you don't have to look anymore in the mirror.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So the black don't look into some things that they can do in order to improve the situation. And I think that this is maybe the big difference between Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King. Malcolm X said, we must look in the mirror. We must go and work and be proud people. He tried to look into the symptoms. He tried to do exactly what the Zionists did to the Jew. Yeah? Mm. The Zionists, the early Zionists, look in the mirror and said, we are the ugliest people on this planet. It's no wonder why everybody hates us. And this is something that happened 50 years before the Holocaust. That we are horrible. We are not productive. We are usurers and so on and so on and so on and so on and so on. Now, instead of that, this kind of form of mirroring, what we see is amplification of victimhood. And victimhood is the complete recipe for paralysis.
Yeah.
And this is why the civil rights movement didn't liberate the black or African communities in America. It just made them more
passive, perhaps?
More passive. Or they made them a receiver of a greater and more devastating form of oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, now you can just go and kill black people in the street in this country, which is devastating.
Yeah, of course.
It is devastating, and this is something that American society, the entire American society, have to deal with. You know, for me, I see it. A year ago, I was on the way to a talk, and I was a bit late in Manhattan, and The guy who drove me made a mistake, and he was stopped by a policeman. And I told him, "Listen, I can I just leave and take my suitcase from the trunk?" And he said, "Gilad, you better not leave now." He told me, "You can leave, but I told him, can I take the stuff from the trunk?" He said, "If you open the trunk, you get into trouble, and if you are black, they would shoot you." It was very natural for him to say it. You know, in this country, if you are in a conflict with a policeman, and by the way, I don't not at all blame a policeman in this country. They are this is something again totally moronic and another betrayal of the left discourse. You know, which is typical. You know. You have a serious problem in this society that you have to handle. You have people whom you decide to put on the battlefront, and then you take it against them.
Yep, exactly. Very
You know,
interesting to see how the media has turned on the
it's
police.
unbelievable. It is unbelievable. It is unbelievable. You know, it is the same in Vietnam. You know, I read a lot of left criticism of a kind of American Sniper, and it's the same story. You know, I saw this film, and my political issue with him is completely irrelevant. He took this battle because he thought that this is an American battle, and it is this society that sent him to a war. You know, I look now again into Vietnam and the way how the way veterans were treated when they came back, and it really hurts me to see how it happened. Not, and again, not because I'm definitely didn't support this war or any other war, you know, but if we send people, soldiers, to a war, we must, as a society, be brave enough to take responsibility and to understand that we are complicit in their crime. You know, even when you deal with soldiers, we're involved in massacres. People don't go and kill women and kids. Most people, really, the vast majority of people, even Americans, even Israelis, they don't do it out of the blue. It is usually we put people in these situations, and there is accumulation of frustration, and that leads into disaster. But we then have to take responsibility as society, and this is something that I don't see in America. You all the time take your frustration and your self-disgust against one cop or another. And again, I'm not justifying any crime, but I think that America has to deal with it in an
Well,
institutional manner.
Gilad, is this way that the automatically the media has assumed that it's now is the cops' fault always, right? And I mean, the question is, if we look at this long term, what's going to happen now? I mean, you're going to have plenty of cops now thinking, you know, I don't want to be, Darren Wilson, right? What if my face ends up there? Their hands are going to be tied behind their back. They're going to now begin to be afraid of doing what they've been trained to do, I think, and that's going to cause even more disaster.
And again, I it's not that I'm telling American people, it's really against my philosophy. I'm not an interventionist. I just as a thinker, I look at it and I see a very strange pattern. It is a pattern that is typical to left thinking. It is the not in my name. When you say not, it's not in my name, you actually say, all right, I'm out of it. It's like everybody else taking responsibility. No, it's your responsibility. It's my responsibility. It's our responsibility. Rather then, you know, engage in sectarian wars. We have to, it's kind of almost pathetic that an ex-Jew kind of preaching a brotherhood to to Christian people, you know. But, you know, I'm an ex-Jew because the message of brotherhood, loving your neighbor, turn the other cheek, made me an ex-Jew, you know. And we must remember that this is the fountain that with pure spring water that led to the creation of Western culture. Not Jerusalem, not hatred, not laws and sectarian wars and cherem and boycott, which is what we learn from, you know, Jewish left. This is the disaster. This is the poison that destroyed nations and people from the day of from the first day of Jewish emancipation.
Right. So, Gilad, obviously we want to get into the language bit here a little bit. I want to talk about, you sent me a very interesting piece here on the Jewish solidarity spin. I wanted to try to connect that, but I think what we could do here actually is we could take a break in a little bit and then pick that up in the second segment here. But before we do that, we have a couple of minutes here.
Yeah.
Just talk about some of the, obviously we want to let people know how they can get a copy of the From A to Z.
Okay, yeah. So it's quite pathetic, you know, the way to obviously it's now available on Amazon, but if somebody really want to destroy me financially, they have to buy 10,000 copies on Amazon, because at the moment I'm losing money. I don't know how it happened on each book we sell on Amazon.
How does that happen? How do they get that control? I always wonder that. I hear that from authors all the time. You know?
I'm not sure. I think that we have to set it up. I think that you tell them what is the selling kind of price, which is, I think, $14.99, which is quite cheap, actually. And then they decide that they buy it from you with 60% discount. So by the time I send the books from England and whatever, it's a slight disaster.
Yeah.
But the best way to buy it is just to go to my website. I'll make it very big. At the moment, it's on my writing forum, but I will actually dedicate a page for it. And there is a shop in America, and they will send it to you straight away. So this is the way to buy it in America and the rest of the world, and in other countries, in the UK and Europe. Again, Amazon. I have the same problem in the UK. I think that we have to sort it out. I'm sure that there is a way to deal with it. In America, I didn't even bother to get it into shops. I think that we have to move into online shopping. You know, it's to make it as cheap, to make things as cheap as possible, and to make them available. I think it's very interesting to see what will happen with this book. I already read today a review in Dissident Voice. He loved the book. Unfortunately, and it's very painful for me, Alan Dershowitz lost all credibility, but I could really benefit from him going against the Fox News and denouncing my work. But, you know, who wants to listen to a person who is implicated in some heavy pedophilia, you know? So
right.
It's really unfortunate.
Yep.
Really, really unfortunate. You know.
Well, Gilad, we're going to have the links up, obviously. Gilad.co.uk is your website. We're going to have the links up to the book from there that people can buy it. And then you have, of course, The Wondering Who and some of the other titles you have available on your store as well on your
website.
For sure.
For sure.
Right, well, very good. Let's just take a short break here, Gilad. We'll return with more shortly. We'll pick up and talk about the other things. We will continue in the second hour and look at the Jewish-Palestinian Solidarity Movement's right of return policy, which lies at the core of the Palestinian plight. We also examine some of the faulty terminology planted within various concepts in the movement that further misleads the discourse and legitimize the Israelis' occupation of the West Bank. Gilad defines the roots of the Hebrew language, and we consider how terminology can be used to turn societies into dysfunctional multiplicities that are dictated by the need to be politically correct. At the end, we spend some time reflecting on the growing opposition to Zionism, the anti-Semitic crime of too much knowledge, and redefining the question of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in order to pursue the truth. An excellent continuation with Gilad Atzmon is coming up at redicemembers.com. You can go there to sign up and tune in. You can stream or download any of our programs in their entirety. We have material going back to 2006, almost 1,000 programs. Some of our upcoming guests for you: Ulla Damegård, Dr. Colin Ross, Thomas Rausel, Greg Johnson, Veronica Clark, Stephen McNallan, and many more. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. Much more is coming up here in the second hour. Thank you for staying with us, and thank you for listening.